Welcome to the podcast of Sozo Church. For more information about Sozo, please visit sozosmtx.com.
How's it going? Oh my gosh, I cannot believe I'm standing up here right now. This is like I'm in a dream or something. And it's crazy, I'm not as nervous as I thought I would be. Joel very timely sent out an email to a bunch of us, and in the email he was talking about how to preach like yourself. And the one line that just like hit me like a freight train was he said, the only time I'm nervous when I'm standing in front of people is when I care more about me than I do about the people I'm preaching to. And man, I think that's why I'm not nervous right now, because I really love you guys. And I think this is one of the most amazing church families on earth. And it's really, really an honor to be standing here and able to share with you some of the things that I feel like God has placed on my heart for us. And I'm not like Joel, I do have notes. They are extensive. So if it looks like I'm like looking down and reading from a script, it probably is because I am. And I'm gonna try to be as natural as I can, but I did plan this out. So the message that I have for us today is titled The Suffering God. And I'm going to be talking about the topic of suffering. And I'm gonna begin by telling you a story. So in the early Christian church, there was two plagues that racked the Roman world, one that happened in 165 and one that happened in 251, and these were believed to be, by historians, to be the first emergence of the smallpox virus in the West, and it devastated the population. They believe that up to a third of the entire Roman Empire perished in this plague. It was really, really bad. And the plague lasted for, the first one in 165 lasted for 15 years. And what they would do is, they had no idea what was going on. They had no diagnosis, no prescription. And so the doctors, the people, the physicians, the people who had means, they would retreat to their mountain homes, bar the gate, leave the city, and get as far away. Anybody who had means got as far away from the general population as they could to protect themselves. And there was even documentation that that the people who couldn't leave, who were still in their homes in the cities, they would lock their door, and if one family member got sick, they would kick them out. Their own blood relatives, they would kick them out onto the street and then close the door behind. And there was a contemporary historian at the time who said that they treated them as if they were dirt. In all of this, Christianity was a budding new religion. And actually, to the Romans, they called Christians atheists. And that was because, you know, Romans, Greeks, pretty much everyone at that time had many, many, many gods, a huge plethora of gods. Christians only had one. And so for a polytheistic culture to have a monotheistic subculture, the monotheists look like atheists. Because you don't believe in any of our gods. You don't believe in Zeus. You don't believe in, you know, all of this. And so they called the Christians atheists, and they were just this small subgroup. It was a movement that was growing, but there's documentation that the only people during these two plagues who would actually go out and help the people who are sick were the Christians. And there's a historian, his name is Rodney Stark, and he wrote a book called The Spread of Christianity. And he basically looked into how did this small group of radical believers flip the entire Roman Empire upside down in a few hundred years, to the point where in AD 400, Christianity was the prominent religion in the empire. Like, how did they do that? And so Rodney Stark is a historian, and he points to these two plagues where there was lots of documentation of these Christians. They would go out and they would serve those who had been cast out on the street. They would take them into their homes, give them food, give them water, give them shelter. They would get sick sometimes and die with them sometimes. But they did all this self-sacrificially. And that blew the ancient world away. And it really was the first time actually Christians invented charity, because we have documentation of a letter that Emperor Julian in 400 AD sent to the high priest of Galatia at the time. And in the letter, he said, hey, what are we doing for the poor? We feeding them? We giving them bread? Like, when? The high priest is like, no. No, we're not. We've never done that. That's not part of our model. And Emperor Julian, he admonished the high priest of Galatia, and he said, hey, look, the Christians don't only take care of their own poor, they're taking care of our poor. We're not even doing that. That makes us look bad, okay? Like, you need to implement a program for feeding and helping the poor. And it was so controversial, because this was the first time that those who had means, those who had strength, used their strength to serve the weak. They used their means to serve the poor. It flipped the world upside down, literally. Flipped the whole ecosystem upside down. And I do work in philanthropy, so I'm seeing the carry on of that. But this is where it all started, is with Christianity. It's the invention of charity. Up until that point, like, why would the strong serve the weak? What purpose is that? So today I want to talk about suffering. And the reason I want to talk about suffering is because if we don't have a grid for suffering and a theology around it, we will be reactive to suffering rather than responsive to it. And so what happens when we're reactive to suffering is that we say stuff like, hey, we recognize our suffering in the world, right? Okay, it's a reality that we're living in. It's part of the human experience. We recognize there's suffering in our life from time to time. And what happens if we don't have a theology of suffering is we'll say stuff like, you know, I'm willing to suffer for the Lord, but I'm not going to sign up for it. Can you imagine if Jesus said that? Every bit of suffering that Jesus entered into was optional. He signed up for every bit of suffering that he experienced on earth. And so I don't think we can afford to sit back and say, I'm just going to take suffering when it happens to come to my door. We have an example of our brothers and sisters in the early century of being proactive with suffering. When we see suffering, we don't actually go, ooh, man, I hope that doesn't come to my door. I hope that disease doesn't come to, and I'm going to close and lock the door and make sure, you know, hedge against that, right? We can't afford to do that. We have to go out of our homes and actually approach the suffering in the world. And so so that's my goal today, is that we would be responsive. We would have a response to the suffering in the world. John Mark McMillan is one of my favorite songwriters. And you might know his name, you might not, but you almost definitely know this one song that he wrote that actually made him famous. It's the song, How He Loves. Pretty much all of us know this song. We love it. It's beautiful, poetic, it's deep. Many of you may not know that this song was actually written from a place of grief, of really deep grief. John Mark McMillan, he had a close friend whose name was Stephen, and he was in the middle of writing this song, and he thought it was no good. And his friend, he showed it to his friend Stephen. It was the first verse. Showed it to his friend Stephen, and his friend was like, "You need to finish this song. This is great. Like, this is amazing." And John was like, "I don't know about that." You know, he wasn't famous yet. He was just kind of writing songs. On the way home from one of their youth meetings, and they were young men at the time, Stephen got into a car accident and died. And that so devastated John, but he remembered what his friend had said about, you need to finish this song. And so he wrote it for his friend. And And when you know that, the lyrics kind of take on a whole new meaning. But there's actually a third verse to that song that that we don't sing in church. We don't sing in worship, but it's there. And if you look it up, it's available online. But I'm going to read to you the last verse of this song. It says, "I thought about you the day Stephen died, and you met me in my breaking. I know that I still love you, God, despite the agony." See, people, they want to tell me you're cruel. But if Stephen could sing, he'd say it's not true because you're good. We have a God that meets us in our breaking. He doesn't just pull us out of it, but he actually steps into it. I wrote this a couple years ago when I was processing my own grief in a season. I said, "It's a beautiful mystery that the one who is the fulfillment of our deepest and most eternal desires sits with us as we experience painful but temporary disappointments. It makes sense why he's often quiet in those moments. He feels our pain and grieves with us, but the answer to our grief is literally himself." Jesus is the all-fulfilling one. He fulfills all of our desires, all of our needs, all of our deepest longings. And yet he comes and he sits with us as we experience earthly pain. And I love the verse in 2 Corinthians 4:16. It says, "These light momentary afflictions are producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond our imagination." I grew up in Japan as a missionary kid and pastor's kid, and in that role, I was the worship leader, I was the youth leader, I was the chair stacker, I was the vacuumer. And I remember one Sunday, so our church was very small. We had 20 people on a good Sunday. And I remember this one Sunday, you know, we're all getting ready to worship, and we all know each other, right? Like, there's almost never someone who walks through those front doors that we don't already know or aren't expecting. You know, it's usually like, okay, someone invited a guest. We all know about it, and we're all, like, really excited. There's going to be a new person. We're going to have 21 people today. And so, you know, I was getting ready to lead worship, and this lady walks in with her two young boys, and nobody knows her. And we're like, "Who are you? How did you find us?" We're like in this industrial building, like tucked way away in the second floor. Like there's almost no signs. So it's not like people could walk in accidentally. So like, "How did you find us?" And she said she had found us online. Furthermore, she wasn't a Christian. We're like, "This is a unicorn. We've never had this happen. What do we do with this?" And so I remember, you know, we finished with worship. I was also a translator for my dad, so I sat up with him. He would give his message. I was, just an aside, I was really tempted to wear a Bucky's hat today because my dad loves Bucky's. He has never been to a Bucky's, but he loves Bucky's. And his one request when our team went over this summer was, he's like, "Please bring me Bucky's merch." And so we're like, "Okay, if that's what you want." So we brought him a Bucky's hat, and he has worn that every Sunday that he's preached since. He wears the Bucky's hat, so. I was tempted, but Birdie talked me out of it. So. Right, yeah, thank you, Birdie. So that was an aside. So I was preaching with my dad, or I was translating for him preaching, and he was talking about the goodness of the Father, the goodness of the Lord. And I remember after the sermon, we would break out into kind of like a Q&A time almost. And in that breakout session, this lady, you know, we asked, like, "Does anybody have any questions?" And this lady, she started, like, asking some really hard questions, what we would call the theodicy questions. If God is really good, why does he allow suffering in the world? If God is really good, what? And if you want a good answer to that, Dustin has an amazing exposition on this question. I'm not going to go into that right now. But she was asking these really hard questions that we all at some point wrestle with. God, if you're really good and you're really powerful, why do you allow suffering in the world? And she was asking these questions, and it was kind of posed as like a theological, philosophical question, right? Like, what? Okay, you're saying God is good, and you believe that he controls the universe, right? And we're like, yeah. And she's like, okay, well, how do you explain this? You know? And it was a laundry list of all the things that were going wrong in the world. And my dad didn't have a good response, and I didn't either. And I remember afterwards, she was sitting by herself, and I went up to her after the service, and I just started talking to her. I'm like, hey, you know, like, how you doing? You know, how did you find us? And just started having this conversation. And in this conversation, she brought up the question again. But this time, it sounded different because we had connected, and I was present with her. She asked the real question that was on her heart. And she didn't ask if God is really good. Why is there suffering in the world? She said, if God loves me like you say he does, why did I go through a divorce? Why am I struggling to provide for my kids? And the thing is, we have a world that's begging for the answer to this question. If God really loves me like you say he does, why am I suffering so much? Why am I in so much pain? Why did I have to go through what I went through? And the thing is, in that moment, I realized I did not have the answer to her question, at least not one that would satisfy her. And you know, I could go into why there's evil in the world, why God can still be good and powerful and there still be suffering, but that's not what she needed. She just needed someone to be present with her in her pain. And I realized that I may not be able to chase away this woman's pain, but I could chase away her loneliness. And that was a revelation that has really served me in the years following, that I may not have the solution, I may not have the answer that can satisfy, but I can be present. That's something I can do. I know I can do that. In a place of deep suffering, there's really no answer that can satisfy. But me being present with her was actually a reflection of what the Father does for us, that he's present with us in our suffering. And when we surrender the need to understand, why am I suffering? God trades us our question for promises. The Bible is full of promises about suffering. One of them is that nothing is wasted. In 2 Corinthians 4:16, it says, therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes, not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. And when you're in suffering, it's good to remember that we're promised that suffering is temporary, but his goodness is eternal. And so it helps to have that perspective. And the second promise is in Hebrews 4:15-16. It says, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. And so that promise is that Jesus really gets it. That he's not just sitting next to you going, well, I hope you make it. I can't relate to what you're going through, but there's goodness on the other side. He's actually with you in it, and he knows what it feels like. I believe in Isaiah, there's a verse that says he was acquainted with grief. He's acquainted with your grief. There is C.S. Lewis is one of my favorite authors. My mom's going to appreciate this reference. But there's a book called The Magician's Nephew that's kind of the prequel to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And it's a different cast of characters, but I'm going to just say the basic is that there's a boy. He's the main character. His mom is very sick and needs a cure. And so he goes on this adventure. It takes him to magical worlds. He ends up in this one world that is just being created. And so Aslan, he's the Jesus figure, right? He creates the world. And it's really this beautiful poetic imagery. Aslan creates the world by singing. So he sings the world into existence, right? This perfect world. And through the main character, his name is Diggory, through his actions, he actually introduces sin into this brand new world. And so, but at the same time, like, he's feeling guilty about it, but at the same time, he meets face to face with Aslan, and he's like, okay, I need to fix what I've done, but at the same time, can you give me anything for my mom? And this is his quote. He's standing in front of Aslan the lion, and he says, but please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure mother? Up until then, he had been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at his face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life, for the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared to Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as compassion. Speaking of compassion and speaking of Jesus, the word, I remember when I was a young teenager, The Passion of the Christ came out. And I remember thinking, why is it called The Passion of the Christ? And if you're part of like old Christian tradition, you know why. But I had never heard passion described in that sense. So I was like, the passion of the Christ, it's about him dying, right? Like on a cross, like suffering a lot. Why is it called the passion of the Christ? For me, passion was like when you really love something. Like I'm passionate about guitars. I'm passionate about, right? And it's, if you actually go to the word passion, where it came from, the etymology, it comes from the Latin word pati. And I'm gonna pull a Joel and I'm gonna ask you to repeat after me. So say pati. Means suffer. And that's where we get the word passion. To suffer. So what do you think compassion means? Any guesses? It means to suffer with. When Jesus was moved by compassion, there was an element where he connected with the suffering in the world. And then what happened? The miraculous flowed always. Through his willingness to connect with the suffering in the world. And that's why, you know, we kind of almost have like a running joke, right? Like, oh, I'll pray for you. Like, almost like it's a pass. Like, someone shares something really hard and we're like, oh man, I'll be praying for you. Bye. You know, like, not right now, just sometime later. You know? And it's the opposite of what Jesus did. Right? Because I'll get into that later. But anyway, suffice it to say, Jesus' example is to actually, when he encounters suffering, it's not to immediately just shove a solution that's going to fix the suffering. His first step was always to connect with those who are suffering. Always. And that's actually the example he sets for us. Let's go to Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18. I love this verse. I'm just going to read it through, okay? For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is your wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach something that satisfies neither of these. We preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. If you were to have a conversation with an ancient Greek person, and you're like, hey, I have a God, he's really powerful, they'd be like, cool. We have a bunch who are really powerful too. You'd be like, well, my God, he came down to be with us. And the Greeks would be like, oh, yeah, ours do that all the time. They come down, have babies, the demigods, they're the heroes of ancient Greece. And you're like, okay, wait. My God came to suffer. And they're like, wait, did you say they came to make you suffer? It's like, no. He came to suffer our suffering. That's when they would be like, you're a fool. That's not a God. Because who, if they were strong enough to avoid it, would opt for suffering? It makes no sense. It's foolishness to the Greeks. Again, John Mark McMillan has another song that I will quote here. And he compares the Greek gods to Jesus. And he has this line in the bridge where he says, Aphrodite would not weep, nor Zeus suffer for the weak, but have you come to stand inside my pain? It was a revolution. Made no sense. There's a story of a man who was born blind, and Jesus and his disciples are walking into a city, and they see this man born blind. He doesn't see them, and he... and... I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. So they see this man born blind, right? And his disciples ask a really interesting question. They said, Jesus, why is this man born blind? Was it his sin or was it his parents? Those were the only two options they could think of. And you know they were bad because the first one makes no sense at all. He was born blind. Was it his sin? What? But that's how much they're like, that's the only explanation we can have. Why? Because we live in an ordered universe where we assume if you do bad things will happen to you. If you do good things will happen to you. Right? That's the logic that Job's friends, by the way, were arguing on when they were counseling Job. They're like, okay, all these bad things are happening to you more than we've ever seen anybody suffer before. You must be the worst person that has ever existed. It doesn't matter that we've been your friends and we know these things are not true about you. They have to be true because we live in an ordered universe. And we, in our human wisdom, we put ourselves in the judgment seat and we go, I can judge God's perspective. And if you read the end of Job, the whole end of Job is just one big, you do not see things the way I do. Where God said, yeah, I love where God jumps in and starts speaking. And it's like drop the mic worthy. So if you've never read that part of Job, it's not all depressing. That part's really epic. I think there's one line where it says, I'm not even gonna try. But yeah, it was really good. So this, where was I going with this? Man born blind. And they ask him, right? Yeah. They're trying to understand, why is this guy suffering? And in their human reasoning, it's like someone must have done something wrong, right? And their focus is, who did the wrong thing? Who did the bad thing to make him suffer? As if that would actually help his blindness. Like, what if Jesus was like, it was his parents? Oh, okay. Sucks to be you. right? Like, what do you get when you get that question answered? You get relief? Do you? Nothing. You get nothing. You get judgment. That's it. And so Jesus turns the question back and he says, it was neither this man nor his parents sin, but this happened so that my power would be revealed in him. Right? Jesus was focused on the glory when we connect with the suffering that's available. And we stay away from sitting in God's chair of why they're suffering in the first place. Jesus experienced lots of people's sufferings. He connected with it, right? Compassion. But we don't call it the compassion of the Christ. We call it the passion of the Christ, right? Because it was his suffering that he took on. And he was, I remember I was talking to Jesus while I was preparing this message, and I was thinking back to the garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is praying, and he's so emotionally spent that he's sweating blood. And he's talking to his father. And what was his one request to the disciples? Stay with me. Stay with me. Pray for me. Pray with me. And what did they do? They fell asleep, right? And he comes back and he's like, come on, guys, I really need you right now. That even the Son of God, in his most dark moment, he craved compassion. Will you be with me in this? Because he knew that after the garden, he was going to be by himself. He was going to be alone. And I remember I was talking to Jesus, and I was like, man, Jesus, I wish I could have been there for you. Knowing what I know, man, I would have stayed up with you. I would have gone with you the whole way. I would have been there for you. And Jesus responded to me. He said, whatever you do for the least of these, you've done unto me. And he reminded me of that verse, and we're going to turn to it in Matthew chapter 25. Sorry, I'm not used to books anymore. 25, verse 34 through 40, and it says, then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by the Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger, invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? And the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And Jesus responded to my question, not my question, but my like, Jesus, I wish I could have been there for you. And he said, you can. Today, you can. He said, when you sit with those who are suffering, you're sitting with me in my suffering. There's an invitation to us as Christians. We flipped the world upside down with this 2,000 years ago. And I believe that it's the key to flipping the world upside down today. I remember I was talking to God a couple years ago, and every now and then I'll kind of go down a rabbit hole into human darkness and cruelty and suffering, and I don't know why, but sometimes I'll just go down, and I remember this one time I was really wrestling. I was like, God, how do you do it? Like, I had kids at the time, right? And I would read a story in the news or something that had, horrible that had happened, and I'd be like, God, if that was my kid, like, forget free will, I'm stopping that. Like, I was like, God, how do you stand by, like, and not do anything when you see the deep suffering in the world? Like, why don't you respond? And I remember God, I've asked that question a lot, and this is the first time I got like a really clear answer. And God said, I did do something. I sent my son 2,000 years ago to die and begin the story of redemption. And then he said, and then he sent you to do the same. What are you going to do about the suffering in the world? So when you ask the question, where are God's hands in the world? Where is God's hand in the world? Everyone raise your hands up. Wave them around a little bit. Look around. This is God's hands in the world. That's God's hands in the world. We are his hands and feet in the world. We are, and God said this, you are my response to the suffering in the world. The church. The church is God's response to the suffering in the world. And just really quick, I want to give you, if the worship team wants to come up, just really quick, I want to give you a couple tools when you encounter someone who is suffering. And this is an analogy that has helped me. If someone is in a place of suffering, sometimes it can feel like they've fallen into a hole, a really deep hole, maybe a well. And you're looking down, and you're like, whoa, you're in a really bad spot. And you're carrying a rope, right? You got a rope on your shoulder. And you're like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to lower the rope, and I'm going to try to pull you out, okay? And you lower your rope, and you try to pull him out, but you actually don't have the ability to pull him out. And you end up straining your back and getting really frustrated. And finally, you're like, you start asking the question, well, why are they in the hole in the first place? Who sinned? Was it this person, or was it their parents? Like, where did things go wrong that they fell in this hole? Right? Because it's easier to do that than to keep trying to tug them out of it. Because you start encountering hopelessness, even in yourself. And that's scary. We get scared of that. So I would challenge you, instead of thinking of it as a hole that someone's falling into, think of it like a valley. Both of them, you've gotten into a low point. There's a lot of reasons you can end up there. It can be your fault. It can be done to you. It can be someone else. It can just be the circumstance of the world. But if you see it as a valley, the difference between a hole and a valley, even though both are depressed places in the earth, one of them has a way forward. When you approach someone who's fallen into a valley, you do have a rope. The rope is not to pull them up. The rope is to let yourself down. David said, "You lead me in paths of righteousness. For your name's sake, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you will pull me out, for you are with me." The psalmist acknowledges that God is leading him. And then he goes to say, even if in my following of you, I walk through a valley, I'm not going to be afraid. We have this idea that if we are obedient to the Lord and we follow him faithfully, that we're going to avoid the valleys. That's not true. We're actually promised that that's not true. In this world, you will have suffering, but take heart. I have overcome the world. I'm going to challenge you that your capacity for others' suffering will increase dramatically when you realize that your job is not to fix their situation, it's to join them. And like I said earlier, you may not be able to chase away their pain, but you can certainly chase away their loneliness. There was Harvard did a study in resilience. And in this study, they studied children who had come out of really hard places, extremely traumatic backgrounds, abuse, neglect, homelessness. And some of these kids beat the odds and made it out. They were able to lead a successful, healthy life. And so Harvard did a study, and they're like, what sets these kids apart who proved to be resilient through the trauma, through the hardship? And you know what's the one factor that they found was consistent through the ones who proved to be resilient? The one factor, and you can look this up, the study's available online. The one factor is that they had at least one healthy relationship with an adult. That was it. It didn't matter who it was. At least one healthy relationship with an adult. That means that the rest who didn't make it didn't even have one healthy relationship with an adult. It really does make a difference when you're not alone in your valley. It really makes a difference. And it seems like if I'm gonna join someone in their valley, I wanna be able to help them out of it. That's not your job. Maybe God will give you tools and things to help them walk forward. But if you're trying to pull people out of it, you're gonna have an anxious response to others' suffering. And you're gonna avoid it because you're like, I don't have the solution. But if you let go of that need to have the solution, you let go of the need to have the answer of why, and you just say, my job is to join you in this. I may not have anything to offer you except for my presence, but you know what? We have studies that prove that's actually what they need, is presence. It's the ministry of presence that Freddie talks about that we discount so easily. It makes a huge difference. I'm gonna finish the story of Rodney Stark, the historian. These Christians would go out into the street, they would care for the sick at a time when people were dying en masse across the empire. And they would give them food and they would give them water. The interesting thing about this disease was that if you just gave people the basic needs of food, water, and shelter, two times out of three, they would recover. And so what they saw in the early church was that by just showing a little bit of compassion, a little bit of mercy, they didn't have the cure to this disease. They didn't even know what it was, but they knew if Jesus were here, he wouldn't be holed up in his house. He would be out in the streets. So they followed him into the streets, sometimes unto death. And what we see historically is that 2/3 of the people that the Christians cared for recovered. They survived. And so even though we may not have the answer to the world's suffering, we may not have all the solutions right now, I believe those come eventually, but step one, the very most basic thing we have to offer is our presence. And we tell the world, you're not alone in your suffering. So if you want to stand with me, I feel like this was a message for us as a church to wake up to the suffering around us, to be empowered and to be encouraged. Encourage means to be infused with courage. It doesn't mean to be told something that makes you feel good, which is what I used to think. It means that God actually comes and he infuses you with courage. And so, church, I just want us to be encouraged, to have the courage to look a world that's suffering in the face and say, I'm here. If you are in a season where you feel like when I described the valley, that's where you are, we want to have a time of ministry. If the ministry team would come forward. And what we're going to do is we're not going to try to pray away the problem. Suffering is not just one problem. If it was, we wouldn't call it suffering. And so if that's you, first, we want to give you priority to come, and we're going to chase away some loneliness. And we're going to chase away the voice that would say, you need to bear this alone and figure it out by yourself. And so I just invite you, while the worship team leads us, to just come get a hug and feel the presence of another person who says, I'm with you in this. I'm going to pray for us real quick. Thank you, Jesus, that you changed the script. You came and you suffered with your creation. And thank you that you invite us into a ministry of reconciliation that starts with compassion. So we pray, God, today that you would awaken our eyes, awaken our hearts, and give us the strength and capacity and the wisdom, God, to follow you into a world that's broken. And I believe, God, that we're gonna see revival, that we're gonna see people come awake to your goodness. We just thank you, God, for your goodness to us.